Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Alan Chartok. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, March 12th. Support for the Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, bringing interventional radiology, immunotherapy, and robot-assisted surgery to cancer care for the greater Saratoga community. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Mohammed Sohail of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. He's here to answer your questions about gastroenterology. Every phone will be lit up, I can guarantee you that. We get a lot of calls, so get yours in now. Don't be complaining to me later on. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. GI issues, your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop. When? Right after this news. Well, hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Mohammed Sohail of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Sohail has been a gastroenterology specialist with Dartmouth-Hitchcock Putnam Physicians at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center in Bennington since 2016. He received his medical degree from King Edward Medical College in Pakistan and completed research training at Yale University. Dr. Sohail completed a gastroenterology fellowship at the University of California, a fellowship in advanced therapeutic endoscopy at University of Massachusetts in Worcester. He specializes in advanced therapeutic procedures, including endoscopic ultrasound, pancreatic biopsy. I'm interested in that one, and stone removal from the bile duct. Dr. Sohail, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thanks, Alan. It's always a pleasure on your show.
Well, everybody worries about their pancreas because that's a very hard one to read in advance. So you do biopsy when you think somebody may have a problem with their pancreas, right? But isn't there a hope that sooner or later we're going to find some way of, you know, checking up on that one before all hell breaks loose?
Yeah, I agree that we do not have any screening test for pancreatic cancer yet. We most of the time find the pancreatic cancer incidentally in a CT scan or MRI, or if the patient is symptomatic with the weight loss or jaundice or yellow skin. We hope that we will have in future any of the blood tests or screening tests like we have for colonoscopy or mammography to find it before the patient develop it.
So, but I've always wondered if we can do it with some of these tests like, you know, that you described, why don't we do that as a regular course?
The data has not shown that these tests will act as a screening test because the prevalence of the pancreatic cancer is still less than we think of. And also, there's a lot of exposure to radiation starting off with that. So we do screen those patients who are higher risk due to genetic modification or alteration or family history of pancreatic cancer. But there's no data established yet that we should screen the regular population with any of the imaging for pancreatic cancer.
Interesting. Okay, so we have a lot of people on the phone already. So, doctor, if you don't mind, we'll proceed with our regular first caller, Jim from Matamoros. Jim, what do you got?
Are the chemicals in fast foods or emotional stress more likely to be behind the increasing gastric reflex?
Hi, Jim. So, yes, there are a connection between what we call a brain and gut axis. So anytime, if any of the stress actually sometime increases the motility of the gut, or if someone is not sleeping very well, or from other stress factors that cause dyspepsia or bloating or other symptoms called irritable bowel syndromes. Of course, there are healthy diet, which has its advantages. The fast food has a high carb, high fat diet, which does increases the load on the stomach and its digestive organs, and does impair its ability to function as compared to the one that is a healthy diet. So I would recommend that healthy diets are always better than the fast food. And obviously, the stress has a lot of impact on our GI tract.
So what's healthy?
So healthy's definition is always anytime we eat a lot of fiber, which is has shown very good for the gut overall. Healthy has to be balanced. Healthy doesn't mean that we should all eat vegetables all the time. It has to be nuts, vegetables, different kind of grains, whole wheat, avoiding too much fried foods, I would say that. Using less kind of oils or when we fry these things, and possibly including the fruits as well, and antioxidants the fruit has, which has also had a lot of anti-inflammatory effect on the gut.
Like which antioxidants do you like?
So there are multiple antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin D, vitamin A in all the fruits, I would say that. Sometimes I call us, I ask my patients to eat a lot of oranges or fruits or strawberries.
Good.
Sometimes the dry fruits has a lot of antioxidants in there as well.
Okay, great. So thank you, Jim.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to Michael in the Hudson Valley. Okay, Michael, you're on.
Yes, hi. How are you, Dr. Sahail?
Michael, I'm very well. Thanks for calling.
Okay, yes, thank you. Okay, I'll try to be brief. I had two surgeries, a shoulder surgery and an elbow surgery, nerve transposition, and so I'm taking a lot of anti-inflammatories, Motrin and Naprosyn and things like this. They also recommended arnica, turmeric, and toprosin. But the problem is it's affecting my stomach, and I'm having a lot of bowel movements and a lot of liquid bowel movements. So I'm just wondering how to offset the need for anti-inflammatories to reduce the swelling with my stomach.
So
the health of my stomach.
So, Michael, that's a very good question. A lot of people actually develop diarrhea or small bowel enteritis or sometimes ulcers in the stomach due to anti-inflammatory. So if you're taking too much anti-inflammatory, I can tell you that you should probably try to minimizing them. Maybe use alternative pain medication, discuss with your primary doctor.
What are some of the alternatives?
So alternative pain medications, depending on the level of pain, he can use Tylenol, Ultram, which is a less anti-inflammatory effect on the gut, and of course, physical therapy or other things, because these anti-inflammatory, Motrin, ibuprofen, Aleve, all these things causes ulcers in the stomach. If they don't cause ulcers in the stomach, they cause ulcers in the small intestine, as well as in the colon as well, and sometimes the people develop diarrhea, actually severe diarrhea, and sometimes these ulcers takes weeks and weeks in the small bowel to heal. So I definitely recommend that to pick some alternative medications if you have these pretty debilitating GI symptoms currently, Michael.
I have to say, you know, everybody says you should take the Tylenol and not the, you know, the ibuprofen. The problem is the Tylenol doesn't work for a lot of people. See.
Yeah, that's true that some Tylenol does not have anti-inflammatory effect, which a lot of orthopedic surgeons want to decrease inflammation around the joints after surgery especially. But of course, if the patients are tolerating okay for a few days or weeks, that's fine. But if they are not, then I recommend that they should talk to your doctor and probably try to switch on to some other medications.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, now we're going to go to Kate in Western Massachusetts. Kate, your turn.
Hi. I was recently diagnosed with small gallbladder stones and polyps in my gallbladder. I don't really get pain, but I get pressure. And I haven't really focused on what I'm supposed to do about it because I just got the diagnosis a week or so ago. The doctor said no fried foods, but I'm concerned about the polyps as much as the stones. Is that something that can turn cancerous?
So gallbladder polyps are actually frequently seen, Kate, when we do ultrasound of the gallbladder. And usually if the size is smaller, I would say when they're less than a centimeter, they can be easily washed. And sometimes actually they regress or fell off from the gallbladder without any problem. And sometimes these polyps are cholesterol, stone, small crystals in the gallbladder. They develop it and they don't have any problem. So I don't know how large your polyp was in the gallbladder. Of course, if it's more than a centimeter, then it definitely need to have aggressive surveillance by doing an ultrasound if you don't want a surgery, or if it is larger than that, then probably a surgical option would be wise to do.
Yeah, he told me I had several small polyps. He didn't give me sizes, per se. But he said if I continued to have the pressure, that I would probably end up having to have the gallbladder removed. I don't really get pain, but I just get, it's just uncomfortable. It just, it's like there's a big air bubble there or something. It's weird.
Right. Sometimes it's hard for me to see that if these polyps they're calling are actually formed from the stones or there actually are polyps, like a tissue growth in the gallbladder. Again, that ultrasound report and the radiologist and your doctor can tell you about that. It sounds like you do have some dyspepsia-like symptoms and pressure-like symptoms. If it is in the right upper quadrant of the abdomen, your doctor or gastroenterologist can do further testing, including a HIDA scan where they put the contrast in the gallbladder and assess its contractility. And if that is dysfunctional, then probably talking to your doctor for further management and possibly even removing a gallbladder can help in your symptoms.
What happens when you remove a gallbladder? What's the consequences?
So the gallbladder removal, about like more than a million of surgeries are done in the United States. Mm-hmm. And some people actually develop diarrhea after the gallbladder removal. It's usually after months or sometimes years because the bile doesn't have a storage place and it comes out of the intestine and the colon cause irritation. It's called a bile salt diarrhea.
So where does that go? Where does that bile go?
So that bile basically comes in the stools, and it causes irritation in the intestine and causes increased stimulation and motility. And sometimes the medications can help in that. But most people, I would say that compared to the number of surgeries we do, most people do okay.
Thank you, Kate. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you want to ask the doctor a question, now's the time to dial the phone. Let's go to Laura in Albany. Okay, Laura, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay? Okay.
Yes, we
Hi.
Are.
Yes. I am wondering, I understand that there's risks to get an endoscopy, but I know they're rare, but I'm wondering, do you know of a location where one could get an endoscopy where you're not put under?
I'm assuming, Laura, you're asking under anesthesia? Versus going through twilight sedation, which we call a moderate sedation. If that's your question, there are multiple centers, and actually every gastroenterologist is usually trained to do procedures either way, depending on the patient's health conditions and sometimes the patient's preferences. So I am pretty sure that if you see your gastroenterologist, they will give you an option of having the procedure in either way, depending on your health condition.
But Laura, you probably don't want to do it. This is Alan, the political scientist, because those drugs make you feel real good. Just a little joke. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I had the opposite experience, but
oh, really? I love it.
Yeah, I was put out. You know, I was. I don't recall the procedure, so right. I don't know if there's something that Alan you did that's different than what I did.
No, I just liked it. It was there I was talking to the doctor, and there I wasn't. Okay, thanks, Laura. Appreciate your call. All right, let's go to, let's see here. We got to take a break now. Zach told me that, and then we'll be right back.
Support comes from Laura Brown of Omay Schenectady, formerly No Nonsense Therapeutic Massage, providing stress and chronic or acute pain therapy using an array of massage modalities. UME.AMTAMembers.com. New York Oncology Hematology, providing second opinions, immunotherapy, and clinical research trials for cancer patients. 31 physicians, 7 locations, NewYorkOncology.com. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. And from Schenectady Symphony, announcing Spring Serenade, featuring Serenade for Strings by Dvorak, Brandenburg Concerto No. 1 by Bach, at the
We're back with you guys. Okay, and we have with us Dr. Mohammed Sohail of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. We so appreciate his being here. Okay, so before we go on, I wanted to ask you something. On at least 2 occasions, today, you've mentioned the potential avoidance of fried foods. So I need a definition of fried in this case. Tonight I was going to make some nice gray sole, put a little olive oil in the pan, and then maybe a little bit of breadcrumb on the top of the gray sole. Is that fried?
Usually we have to put a little bit of oil on everything, you know, so that we can cook it well. And when I say fried food, I'm giving an example of like you putting the oil and keep frying multiple times in the same oil.
Right.
That oil, actually cooking it multiple times, the same oil breaks the bonds in that and makes it less actually healthier than that. So
fried chicken or fried potatoes. Or
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Of that. And already these foods have high carb on the top of the fried food, so that can just make the thing.
So, what's your favorite oil to use?
I usually use vegetable oil. Olive oil is also very good. Yeah. It has a lot of antioxidants in it.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so now we're going to go right over to Mary, who's been patiently waiting in Graham Hill, New York. Okay, Mary, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a ruptured diaphragm years ago, and they did surgery, and that didn't hold. So the second time they had surgery, they put a stent in. Now my stomach is bothering me, and I wonder if I have H. pylori. Can they do an endoscopy when you have a stent?
Mary, thanks for calling us. I'm just a little confused that where did they put the stent in?
In the esophagus.
Why did they put the stent in your esophagus?
It was twisted.
Do you have...
Because the diaphragm ruptured and the stomach came up in my chest and it made the esophagus twist.
Okay. Did they tell you when they're going to remove the stent?
No. I think it's going to be forever. I don't know. They never told me when they... if they're going to remove it or not.
Okay. Usually the esophageal stents are get removed. If they are for benign conditions, we remove it after the condition gets better, and usually for the malignant condition. So I'm not sure that if the esophagus was twisted, unless your esophagus was ruptured or something, and they needed to repair it by putting a stent in.
Well, the diaphragm was ruptured. My last trial was 10 pounds, 5 ounces, and I think he finished it off.
it is possible. I think that you should see a gastroenterologist if you think that you have the GI conditions and you think the endoscopy is needed to check H. pylori. Although H. pylori, if you're worried, it can also be tested in your stools, which is a non-invasive test. Then,
they can find for H. pylori in the stool also?
Yes. There's a stool test for H. pylori, and if you have symptoms, even your primary doctor can order the H. pylori stool test.
Okay, and also I wanted to know, I can't vomit because of the stent, but when I get a virus, it comes up there and then it hits over on the vagus nerve and then I pass out. Is that going to be forever?
There are two possibilities can be. One is that you could have a vasovagal syncopal response because your vagus nerve is very sensitive, and that can be due to multiple reasons. And again, I'm not sure the stent story still. If that stent sometime can cause compression of the vagus nerve, if it's in the esophagus and can cause symptoms of vasovagal syncope. And I think in either of these two things, I think you should, if this stent is truly in your food pipe, you should check with your gastroenterologist, PCP, or primary doctor, because we usually do not leave the stent in forever.
Mm.
Mary, thank you. All right, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go now to Betty in Albany. All right, Betty, you're on.
Yes, doctor. I would like to know, is there much bleeding with a esophageal biopsy?
Betty, so thanks for calling. There is almost no to negligible risk of bleeding from esophageal biopsy. The people who are at high risk of bleeding are on are either they're on blood thinners like Coumadin or other medications like aspirin or clopidogrel. But if they're not on that, I would say there's almost very, very small to negligible risk of bleeding from the esophageal biopsy.
So I am on warfarin, but I have to hold it for 3 days. And so if you're off of it, then is there still a high risk for bleeding?
Yes, if you're off for 3 to 4 days, I think that risk is almost same to the person who's not on any medications.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you, Betty. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. You heard me, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Lee in Gloversville. Okay, Lee in Gloversville, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Lee?
Not too bad. Got a quick question. Probably about 30 years ago, I had a bowel resection due to a weak spot in my intestines. And probably within the past 7 years, I've been in and out of the hospital due to an obstruction not allowing me to go bathroom. And I was just wondering, I mean, they've done all the tests. I've done MRIs. I've had CAT scans. I've had colonoscopies, and they haven't been able to give me an idea of what's going on. I was wondering if you had any ideas.
So, Lee, I think given the fact that you had surgeries in the past and you probably had a partial bowel obstruction where it gets better after not eating in the hospital for a few days, I'm assuming that's what's going on. And I'm assuming that your CT scan with contrast, oral, and IV didn't show any problem or spot where the obstruction is. So that becomes sometimes a challenging scenario because of the scarring or adhesions due to your previous surgery around the intestine causes sometimes, in general terms, we call a kink. And sometimes that scarring inflammation gets better after not eating for a few days, IV fluids in the hospital. But I would say that I would make sure that your gastroenterologist or the doctors who are seeing perform, if they're not finding any other cause, make sure you don't have any inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease or anything else causing. And sometimes even the capsule endoscopy where they evaluate the entire small bowel, if you say your endoscopy and colonoscopy is normal, will be helpful in further diagnosing you.
Yeah. Yeah, they said they didn't, they were able to get up with the colonoscopy as far as they could. They didn't, you know, see any issues. But that's like what you were saying, you know, it's like going into the hospital and then not eating for a couple of days and then, you know, it clears up. You know, that's so, pretty much what I was thinking. And
so
go ahead.
I would say that if your gastroenterologist can perform a capsule endoscopy, which is like a pill camera, that pill camera you swallow and takes the picture of the entire small intestine, and sometimes if there's any small ulcers or obstructions or anything like that, it can pick it up. Of course, prior to that capsule endoscopy, they make sure that your entire bowel is open by doing a patency capsule, which is like a test before that. I would probably advocate that if you can have that done to further delineate your problem.
Thank you, Lee. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Joe in Cherry Valley. Okay, Joe, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Doctor, I've had lymphocytic colitis for 4 years, and around Christmas time this past year, I came down with a C. diff infection, another form, a different form of colitis. And for 4 years, I've been taking budenocide, the steroid, and 6 milligrams a day is what I've been taking. Now that I'm, you know, at the tail end of the C. diff experience, it's been raised to 9 milligrams of budenocide a day. I wondered if you could just speak to the risks and benefits of budenocide as a steroid.
Joe, so I think if you have a C. diff...
Hold on one second. Joe, you've got to turn down your radio, please, because we're getting your feedback.
I don't have a radio on right now.
Well, something strange. Okay, go ahead, Doc. Sorry.
So if you have a C. diff, your doctor will treat the C. diff on the priority basis. And then once your C. diff is treated and cured, and if you still continue to have diarrhea, then they can start on low-dose budesonide. It does have some small risk. Risks are way less than taking oral prednisone. Budesonide usually gets metabolized first in the liver, so a lot of the drugs is actually get metabolized before really going into your blood and affecting other organs. But of course, the long-term budesonide still has the same side effects of steroids, usually osteoporosis or bone demineralization. That is the major side effect of long-term taking of budesonide, a risk of infection, a risk of hyperglycemia, or other risks comes along with the long-term intake of budesonide.
How scared should I be about a long-term, budesonide treatment?
If your symptoms are overwhelmingly debilitating, that you have to take it when it says symptoms, you have a diarrhea of at least more than 6 to 7 bowel movements a day, you get dehydrated, then definitely you need to be on a long-term budesonide. But if your symptoms are 1 to 3 bowel movements a day, then usually we taper off the budesonide and sometimes start the patients on some of the alternative lower tier medications, which are not as effective as budesonide, but definitely they have less side effects than budesonide.
But steroids, which is what he's worried about, are never really great things to be putting in your body, right? Am I wrong about that?
I agree, Alan. Steroids are definitely not a great drug for a lot of purposes, but they have side effects. But we usually treat the patients when they have acute illness with the steroids. Unfortunately, a lot of diseases in the GI have step-down medication from steroids that we start on the patients.
Thank you, Joe. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now over to Tam in Delmar. Okay, Tam in Delmar, you're on.
Hi. I have had an endoscopy. I heard someone talk about an endoscopy without conscious sedation, or sometimes they call that Versed. I feel that Versed is an amnesiac, and I don't like the idea of drugs interfering with my memory, although it does feel wonderful. So I did the endoscopy. I had no pain at all. I just had to kind of concentrate on not being fearful. I've also had a cataract removed in both eyes and colonoscopies with no Versed. So it's totally possible. I just wanted that listener to know.
Yeah. Tam, I think that's what the doctor told her. She could do it. She could do it.
I had a question that when I was 35 years old, I'm 68 now, I suddenly could not digest anything. And I found out I had endometriosis on my bowel. And a laparoscopy removed some of it. I still have trouble digesting foods now and have to eat very clean, pure, simple food. I wonder if there's any hope for me getting over that. I attribute it to the endometriosis and maybe scar tissue on my bowel, but I'm not sure.
So, Tam, that's a good question. Endometriosis of course, is a disease of the childbearing age most of the time, and it can involve any part of the GI tract and cause a lot of scarring and dysmotility of the GI. Usually, the patient has to be treated with contraceptive medications to control the endometriosis. But once it's invaded different organs sometime, it causes a lot of scarring and dysmotility. And if it involves and cause obstruction to that point, then surgery, of course, is a treatment. But for milder symptoms, if it is depending on the kind of symptom, if you have a constipation, you have to take a stool softeners. If you have a diarrhea, usually take antidiarrheals. And mainly you treat the endometriosis with your OBGYN doctor's advice.
Okay.
Thank you, Tam. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. We've got very few minutes to go in the program. I want to move as fast as I possibly can without being rude, something I'm occasionally accused of. Let's go to Diane in Northampton. Okay, Diane, you're on.
Hi. I have IBS with diarrhea for the past 5 years, and it comes and it goes, and when it comes, like I'm going through a period of it now, it's almost uncontrollable. Is there anything outside of changing my diet, which I've done and that didn't work? Is there anything out there for a person like me?
And good, while you're at it, Doc, could you tell us what IBS is?
So IBS is an irritable bowel syndrome, which it stands for. People have to have meet the ROM criteria, which is like three different symptoms have to meet for at least 6 months. And it can be constipation predominant, it could be diarrhea predominant, it could be alternating with diarrhea and constipation. So, Dan, coming back to your symptoms, which you sound like is diarrhea predominant, and you have off and on of these symptoms, there are actually some good medications other than diet, although the diet has shown to have the highest success, which is called a FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P. It is basically contains less of the oligosaccharides and disaccharides and a lot of grains. And if you cannot and it's difficult to make, then there are certain medications. One of the medications, amitriptyline, has been used, which is initially was used for depression, but it actually works very well for IBS patients and also helps in controlling the diarrhea symptoms as well. Some other medications over the counter, like loperamide or Imodium, has also been used for irritable bowel syndrome.
Okay, we gotta take a break. Thank you, Diane. The telephone number here, although all the lines seem to be tied up right now, is 1-800-348-2551. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the bariatric program at Adirondack Health, Saranac Lake, offering weight loss surgery and lifestyle education. Better health, better lives. AdirondackHealth.org. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering flexible social work graduate degrees, including a part-time Master of Social Work program, combining on-campus and online coursework. Adelphi.edu/MSW. Act Smart New York, Saratoga Springs, offering individualized outpatient counseling and Suboxone treatment for opioid use disorder and medical treatment for alcohol problems, actsmartnewyork.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Gerhonkson, New York, helping fight the epidemic opiate crisis both locally and throughout the country with specialized programs, education, and support for men, women, and families, villaveritas.org for inquiries. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org.
Very well done, Ray Graff. We thank you so much for joining us for that live from the studio. We are here. We are with Dr. Mohammed Sohail of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. We're delighted that he's with us. He's obviously a very bright and good guy. So let's then go to, I'm looking for who's been on the longest. Yeah, obviously it's Richard of Poughkeepsie. All right, Richard of Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you for taking the call. I know you're in a rush, so I'll make it quick. In the final months of my mother's life, she had C. diff, which was very intractable. And, of course, she was on antibiotics and things like that, which made it even worse. But every time she went in the hospital, they took her off all drugs so they could, which was nutty. My question really is C. diff a growing problem in the population? And secondly, are people becoming, hospitals and clinics becoming more sophisticated about how to treat it and what precautions they should take? Thank you.
Doc, before you even answer, tell us what C. diff is.
So, Alan, C. diff is a bacteria which actually invades the colon, and it's usually due to the alteration in the good and bad bacteria, I would say that, in the gut. And usually the major cause of C. diff is a prior treatment of antibiotics, which we take from range of antibiotics of ciprofloxacin or fluoroquinolones to penicillin. And the second thing is the contact. And, of course, elderly people who already have less immunity, hospitalized, they get the C. diff from either transmission from other patients in the hospital. And it is, coming back to the Richard question, that it is a growing problem as our geriatric population is rising, and we have a longer life expectancy than the people are hospitalized multiple times, especially, and same thing in the nursing home population as well. Of course, the hand washing, anytime we even visit or see a patient, it's important that we wash our hands, not just cleaning with There's like detergents or something we use for cleaning. And we have hospital, of course, follow certain protocols. Anytime the C. diff patient gets admitted in the hospital to clean the room before they get discharged, we also have a contact precautions. We wear certain gloves and certain gowns before entering the patient's room. But definitely, we do not have any vaccination to prevent the C. diff yet. We do not have any great drugs as well, especially to prevent the recurrent C. diff. We usually do the fecal transplant, which is a new thing, getting from the patients who are healthier and transplant the patients who have a C. diff to prevent the recurrent episode of C. diff.
What do you do there? I'm sorry, you transplant what?
We transplant the feces. Well, it sounds like pretty odd, isn't it?
So if somebody has feces in them, do you take out that and put somebody else's in?
Right. Right.
Okay.
And that basically, the whole idea is to equilibrate the gut microbiome or the gut bacteria. That basically prevent the further episodes of C. diff.
Of course, you have to be careful who you're taking from to put in, right?
Right. We do plenty of tests to prevent and make sure that the patients we're taking off, our donors, doesn't have any other infection.
Couldn't help but ask that question. Thank you. Okay. And now let's go to Robert in Kamisha. Okay. Robert, you're on. Go.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 58 years old. In December, I had a routine colonoscopy and an endoscopy regarding an intense burn I had in my esophagus. The endoscopy showed a hiatal hernia, which is new, and Barrett's esophagus. The Barrett's esophagus is the thing that's really bothering me and worrying me. And the doctor said it was 3 centimeters or less.
Okay.
Can you tell me more about that and what I should expect in the future?
So Robert, Barrett's esophagus is basically changes in the lining of the food pipe or esophagus, where the normal lining of the esophagus gets changed by the lining similar to the stomach, which is not supposed to be there. And that we call it dysplasia, and then it turns into a cancer over the years. It is not something that develops into cancer immediately. When I say immediately, like within months or even years, if the Barrett's has no dysplasia, which means that it has no advanced cancerous cells and just a simple Barrett's esophagus, I would say not to worry about it too much. There are medication that you have to take indefinitely so far called acid medications. There are multiple on the counter right now available that you have to take, and make sure that you go Go ahead.
Omeprazole being one of them?
Right. There are multiple. Omeprazole, lansoprazole. You can take any of them depending on your tolerance or your doctor prescribes. And then your doctor would recommend you to come back in either 3 or 5 years based on your risk factors to have a repeat endoscopy and have a second look on that.
Well, I'm having actually a follow-up endoscopy on April 26th, and this is from December. He wants to do another endoscopy on the 26th of April. What was I going to say? He did take a biopsy. It didn't come back with cancer at all. So I'm in pretty good shape with that, you're saying?
So, Doc, what's 3 centimeters like?
So 3 centimeter, so Barrett's we divide into a short segment or long segment Barrett's esophagus. Short segment between 1 to 3 centimeters. And long segment is when it's involved more than 3 centimeters of the food pipe.
Well, what does centimeter look like in terms of your fingernail?
So I would say that, well, 3 centimeters are pretty small. I would say, like, in my fingers, I don't know, large or small, but I would say that it's almost like 1/5 of the finger.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Of the fingernail?
Not the nail. Oh. I'm talking about the finger. So probably 3 centimeters is like, again, equal to like 3 or 4 nail, uh-huh. length of the nails.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And
that's a lot more than I thought it was.
Yeah, but it's...
But,
that's why I asked the question.
So esophagus itself is at the length of 30 centimeters. So it's not very large area compared to what we think.
Right. Well, Barrett's can be a tough disease. You know, people have had it for many, many, many years. They go in and it doesn't move. I think maybe it's from an original burn, and then after that, after you wash this up, Barrett's can be...
And that's a good question. Certain actually conditions predispose someone. People have a long-term acid reflux. They develop the Barrett's. People who are actually obese, obesity predisposes to Barrett's esophagus.
Smokers.
Smokers and alcohol. So all these 4 or 5 risk factors, along with certain members who could have a family history of esophageal cancer. But the Barrett's are usually these are 3 or 4 things which actually predispose someone to develop this condition.
So, Robert, you're not going to do any of that stuff, right?
Not going to do any of that stuff at all.
Okay.
And I haven't in the past.
Okay, great.
So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
So wait, one more question. Would I expect in future years to possibly develop the cancer?
No. So not everyone, again, the risk of cancer is very small. Some people actually taking the medication and changing the lifestyle, their Barrett's can disappear.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
I haven't had any reflux since I started taking the omeprazole. And, you know, but I am belching quite often. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Yeah, belching can or cannot have a relation with that. Sometimes the people just ingest a lot of food when they eat, and that causes the air when they eat, and that causes a
eat less,
bloating problem.
Robert. Eat less. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to Linda in Albany. Okay, Linda in Albany, you're on.
Hello. Since February 1st, I have been in chronic pain on the left side of my body, the rib cage, underneath the rib cage, toward the back, no pain on the right side. I've been to my doctor, who's an internist. She at one point recommended that I go to the ER, where I spent 11 hours. I've been tested, blood tests, CAT scan, ultrasound, stool samples. I'm not eating dairy. And the pain is terrible, and I can't go without having pain pills, hydrocodone, which I'm terrified of becoming addicted to. Before, I took no drugs at all. And so nobody seems to have come up with anything. I am scheduled for an endoscopy April the 3rd. I have to wait till April the 3rd to have a sit-down and then schedule the endoscopy.
Linda, sorry to hear that you've been going through all that. I think that is the right decision that your primary doctors refer you to a gastroenterologist. They will probably evaluate you and see that. What is your differential diagnosis if you're a pain, and then probably they will decide if you need an endoscopy or not.
So you have nothing to offer from what I said. Oh, another question. I also looked up diseases from bed bug parasites, and I have 10 of those. I sound like a hypochondriac, but I swear I'm not. Bed bug. I'm 70 years old, and I have rarely been sick. So I'm wondering if this could be a possible repercussions from a bed bug.
Okay, we're going to let him answer that, and then we've got to go. Go ahead, Doc.
Yeah, I can't think of the bed bugs that usually cause itching or rash. They usually don't cause back pain that you're describing, Linda. But again,
the parasites can go into the organs, according to what I researched.
They can go underneath the skin. They form the antigens or the toxin, which causes itching or rash. But again,
I had that, but that went away.
Well, then it may not be the bed bugs, Linda. It may be something related to your spine, something related with your kidneys or your gut. Again, your doctor will take a complete history and examination and will give you the best advice.
Thank you, Linda. Okay, and now we're going to go to Gisela in Saratoga. Gisela in Saratoga.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Doctor. I'm calling in regards to the two people that called. One has colitis and the other one IBS. I have a very small hiatal hernia. I get acid reflux, but getting back to the IBS and the colitis, I'm a herbalist, and I have found slippery elm powder. I don't know if you ever heard of it, and it totally takes care of the colitis, IBS. If I get acid reflux, I'll take a little bit. You know, it's all natural. It is the most
okay,
most
Gisela,
awesome
hold on.
Product that I have ever found.
We're sort of running out of time here. Doctor, do you have any response?
I think one thing I need to clarify is that irritable bowel syndrome is not a colitis. People often confuse the two things together. Colitis is usually we call due to some underneath inflammation, which the word stands for it. Irritable bowel syndrome is not a colitis. We should separate in that. And yes, irritable bowel syndrome can be helped. Sometimes the natural medications can be helpful.
Thank you. Okay, let's go now to Gordon in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Gordon, we're running out of time, so make it quick. Go ahead.
Doctor, I've had a flare-up with the colitis, and I wondered about the effects of Lialda. And I'm wondering if there's any, because I've been having issues with stools, you know, more diarrheic. And I'm wondering about binding foods and what you would recommend, like aloe vera, would that be good? And just what the side effects are, Lialda.
So, Gordon, it sounds like you have either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, I'm assuming, one of them. You have ulcerative colitis?
Yes.
Yes. So Lialda or any of these mesalamines your doctors or gastroenterologists will prescribe you, their dose need to be adjusted according to your symptoms. It sounds like if you're still having some GI problems, your dose may be maintained at highest dose for a couple of months. There are certain foods actually have shown to have some benefit in the colitis patients, eating high fiber diet, rich in nutrition, antioxidants, and fruits and vegetables. That can help in regulating your some of the symptoms and bowel movements. But of course, if you have inflammation, if the doctor finding on a colonoscopy, then definitely you need to be treated with the medications for that. And I think sound like you're on the right medications already.
Thank you, Gordon. Okay, we're not going to give the phone number anymore because we're sort of running out of time here. Very quickly, let's go to Kevan in Hudson. Okay, Kevan in Hudson, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about I had acid reflux a couple of years ago, and I have I went to the GI and they put me on omeprazole. But my question is, it seems like when I eat a lot of like wheat food, I have a lot of gas. I wonder if that has any correlation with the stomach problem that I have.
So you're saying, Kevin, that you have gas in your stomach? You produce, feel like bloating?
Yeah, bloating all the time, and it depends, you know, I eat certain things that I eat. I have a lot of gas. I'm also lactose intolerant. I don't you know, mess with the dairy products at all, but I seem to have a lot of gas no matter what I eat.
So it appears if you're saying that if you eat a lot of wheat or whole wheat and your symptoms of bloating gets worse, you may want to check yourself with your doctor for celiac disease, that you don't have that. And if your doctor will check with a blood test and may do an endoscopy for that. And, of course, other causes of bloating or just dyspepsia or even acid reflux. And sometimes the lifestyle, the diet kind of like we eat, and all these things. So various things are involved that can cause it, but I would definitely think that if you have symptoms of bloating with the wheat, then definitely celiac disease is one of the things that you definitely want to check out.
Thank you, Kevan. Okay, now we're going to go to Bob in Schenectady. And Bob in Schenectady, this will be our last call. We do apologize to Armin in Greenfield and Don in Woodstock because we're just not going to have enough time to get to them. But Bob in Schenectady, you have limited time, so go ahead.
Thank you very much, doctors. Good afternoon. Very quick question. I'm on Entyvio. I've had UC for about 10 years. Is postnasal drip a possible side effect of Entyvio?
Bob, thanks for calling. I'm not sure that if it is a common side effect or even a rare side effect of Entyvio per se. It could be that you have any polyp or anything in the back of your nose that is contributing to your drip or could have allergies. Entyvio can cause a transient allergic reaction, and that can cause, of course, itchy nose and itchy eyes and things like that. But if you have a persistent postnasal drip during the course, then it's probably not due to Entyvio. You may want to check with your ear, nose, throat doctor to see that what is the cause and the problem above your oropharynx and nasopharynx.
Well, I have a CT scheduled for Wednesday for exactly that.
Well, so you're on the right track, and so is our doc. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Okay. We we're so sorry to Armin of Greenfield, Massachusetts, and And Donna in Woodstock, Armin wanted to know something really quickly, Doc, and I can't put her on the line because we don't have time, whether or not precancerous tissue in the esophagus, can it be fixed?
I think depending on if the precancerous tissues, yes, if they are having any dysplasia or anything, the doctor can burn those precancerous tissues quickly with endoscopy and they can be removed sometime by endoscopy. Yes, they can be treated.
Okay. We're out of time. My apologies to Armin and Donna of Woodstock. I want to thank Dr. Mohammed Sohail of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center for being with us today. You did a terrific job, Doctor. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan.
WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. So now, stay tuned for a news update.